This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 10th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 192, with me, Andrew Tuck, and Sophie Grove.
Today we'll be talking to author Paul McMahon about the global politics of food and why keeping the planet fed is not simply a case of supply and demand.
We'll also be learning a thing or two about good ideas, why some catch on while some just don't. Jonah Berger will be joining us later.
And here's a good idea, starting your own currency. We'll meet the entrepreneur Stan Stolniker, who's attempting to do just that.
All that to come, and we'll also be joined by Tom Edwards to hear next week's news, and no doubt a song or two too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Well, hello, Sophie.
Well, hello.
Mr. Robert Bound isn't here. He went to Geneva last week and has been missing in action ever since. That's what happens when you have friends in Geneva.
He's also on a very important assignment, partly dispatched by me, in fact, to interview some very eminent head of some very wonderful motoring companies.
Oh, good.
I'm not giving too much away.
Well, he was at the Geneva Motor Show. We can give that bit away. I think he's had a fine old time. I did do a check-in, and he kept referencing the ladies kind of lying across the bonnets more than the what was underneath them. I think he was having too good a time, actually.
Possibly. That sounds like he's getting the inside track anyway.
I'm going to be looking very carefully at his expenses when he gets back. You've been in London all week.
I have. We're sort of recovering from lots of trips and a rather frantic production week last week.
And we've also started work on an epic task, which is the first Monocle book, which is going to be published by Gestalten in the autumn. And it's a huge, hefting thing. And I think that there was a kind of like a horrible moment of realisation this week that we're all a bit behind.
I'm trying not to call it a tome, because it has sort of negative connotations of being rather cumbersome and a bit of a monster. But let's face it, it kind of is.
It's a bit of a monster at the moment, but we're going to tame it. We're going to tame it. We're going to put it on a bookshelf somewhere near a bookstore near you, and it's going to be very beautiful. But anyway, you know what it is? It's that time of week where we invite in somebody else. Mr. Tom Edwards, who's going to tell us all about the world as he sees it from his desk. He's going to be here in just a second to give us the news for next week.
Bringing you all the news you need. It's Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards.
This may be my favourite point of my whole week, every week.
It's definitely one of my favourites.
Because I always have a surprise for you, and I've got another surprise for you.
Take it away, Andrew.
Take it away. It so happens, if you put Tom Edwards into the world of the internet machine, it will come up with a link on Wikipedia to another Tom Edwards who bears an uncanny resemblance to you. This is the biography of one Tom Edwards, born 1945.
Close.
He was on Radio Caroline. He returned to pirate BBC Essex on board LV18 Halfpenny Pier in Harwich, Essex. That's the wrong accent, but anyway, that's quite good. He's written an unpublished biography suggested by the comedian Bob Monkhouse when they worked in television on the television series Wipeout in the 1990s. And he lives alone in the village of Heckington. Is that you?
That is uncanny. almost every aspect of that describes me completely accurately.
Tom Edwards, there's two of you in radio.
I know. Well, now I feel like there's only one, because his career is so illustrious.
You've merged, isn't it? But do people come up to you and say, you're not the Tom Edwards that lives alone in the village of Heckington, are you?
No, they quite often ask me if I'm the BBC London transport correspondent, Tom Edwards.
Is there another Tom Edwards that does that?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, there must be a few Andrew Tucks.
Do you know that the annoying thing, there's an Andrew Luck, who's, I think, a famous basketball player. Luck and Tuck, they get a bit confused. So occasionally someone's...
But there's no more Andrew Tucks.
There's an Andrew Tucker, who oddly is a journalist, and there's a woman called Lucy Tuck, who's a very successful British journalist. And when I was aspiring, people used to say, is that your sister or is that your aunt? And there's no connection at all.
But you'd always say, oh, yes, it's
no,
the
No, I didn't.
Tuck.
I was like, no,
it's the
no.
Tuck. It's the Tuck journalism
dynasty. I'm here on my
dynasty.
Own. I've started my own fresh dynasty. Anyway, that's that. Tom, we've got you here to tell us what's going to happen over the next week. Where would you like to start?
I'm going to start with the Falkland Islands referendum. That's taking place today and tomorrow.
Or for our listeners in Argentina, Malvinas.
Malvinas, of course. Sorry, I should have said both, of course.
No. We'll stick with the Falklands.
Islanders go to the polls. It's a simple yes or no question. Do you wish the Falkland Islands to retain their current political status as an overseas territory of the United Kingdom? Now, this has obviously been quite contentious, I think it's safe to say. It seems likely that the poll will, you know, result in a pretty convincing victory to keep the status quo. I just think it'll be very interesting to look at some of the, you know, peripheral issues. What will response be from Argentina? Obviously, you've had Cristina de Kirchner being very sort of outspoken about this, quite antagonistic, you might almost say. And the United Kingdom has attempted to be fairly diplomatic insofar as we're good at doing that. But I just think it'll be very interesting to see what the kind of the response will be to that referendum.
Is this a regular thing? Because there aren't that many people there. And a straw poll would tell you that most of them are quite patriotic and want to stay part of the, you know, the great empire of the United Kingdom, or part of the United Kingdom. Is this sort of part of a diplomatic effort to convince de Kirchner that she should leave the Falklands alone?
Yeah, I mean, it's very much the United Kingdom's position on this, is that they won't make any change to the status of the islands without the full endorsement of the people. And as you correctly surmise, you know, that's unlikely to be a surprise. And I think the problem comes from, it's the old question about these old, I guess you could call them almost colonial outposts. If you ask the people there, they're going to give one answer, you know. But of course, Cristina and her ilk would say in Argentina, well, let's ask everyone in Argentina what they think. But clearly that would give a rather different answer.
And obviously it's been an attempt by the government to kind of wrong foot them a bit. It's bound to be a 99% vote, I would imagine, in favour of staying with the UK. And so, but does it really have any hope of kind of calming down the conversation, do you think?
I think, to be honest, I think it's unlikely to do that. And if anything, it'll probably prove rather incendiary, because, you know, the government of the United Kingdom, I think, will say, well, look, we did what we promised. We've had a referendum. The answer is final. And that's that. And there's no more room to even discuss this. And I think that that's probably unlikely to be met with a particularly welcome response in Buenos Aires.
OK, is there a jollier one second?
No, I had something much more depressing.
Shall
I
just... Oh, no, go, no, do the depressing one. Do the depressing one,
well, no, I just
and
feel,
then we'll cheer up afterwards.
I feel we should recognise tomorrow, of course, March the 11th, 2 years to the day since the earthquake and devastating tsunami that struck Japan, of course. We all know about what happened. There was the problem with the nuclear reactors in meltdown, unprecedented levels of damage, unprecedented scale, magnitude of this disaster. And it'll be interesting, plainly, to look at, you know, the responses there, the acts of commemoration, but also to see, you know, to kind of take the temperature a little of Japan. You know, what have they learned? What kind of, you know, shifts there have been in terms of policy? We had a lot of debate about the nuclear issue particularly. And then more broadly about how you prepare, predict and tackle these kind of natural disasters. And we'll obviously be looking at that in some detail on Monocle 24 tomorrow.
On a more kind of interesting note, upbeat note about that. We had quite an interesting trip this week. Me and Tyler, we were invited by the Japanese political attaché here in London to go to his pad for a drink or two. And he did a little reception. And he partly did that reception to say thank you, actually, to Monocle for being interested and supportive of what happened in Japan after the earthquake. And it was great because we took along Yoshi, who works for us. And Yoshi, as you may remember, made a kind of little kind of wristband thing which sold and generated money to help some of the most devastated communities. So it was amazing meeting so many people, and still, you know, it's still such a, you know, obviously a live topic for them. The only other thing was, poor thing, he hasn't got a great flat, because what happens to all these diplomats? They get posted to these apartments that haven't been decorated since 1960. So it was kind of a bit stuck in a time warp. I think he may need some help from Yoshi, who's very good at interior design.
Yoshi would probably send him some blueprints of a new layout for his flat.
I think Yoshi was kind of looking around, because he came with us. Yoshi was looking, maybe I could build a few little bookshelves here for you. Is there a jollier one to end on, Tom?
Well, a little jollier. What about David Bowie? So his first album in 10 years is released on Tuesday. We also had a lot of fanfare on his birthday. Recently, he released his first single. For some time, that was on his 66th birthday back in January. But this new album is coming out. Pretty exciting for watchers of the... I was going to call him a glam rock legend, but he kind of bestrides the musical scene, doesn't he? He's kind of without category.
Did you think the single was any good?
I thought it was a solid effort.
Oh, that's not a vote of confidence, is it?
I wasn't a big fan, but I want to hear the entire work. I want to hear the whole album so that I can digest it in more detail.
Well, bless him, because it's his moment, isn't it? Being the exhibition at the V&A, everybody's back on the Bowie train.
we thought that he was going to appear at the Olympics. There was all this stuff about British music. There was a great literal fanfare, and he was featured. And we were like, oh my goodness, David Bowie is going to be live before the world.
Instead, we saw Emily Sandé five times.
Exactly. And let's be fair, that's no substitute.
No. Thanks, Tom. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We'll be learning how to make food go further just after this. With the current horse meat scandal making its way from Europe now over to the US and beyond, there's never been a more global focus on our food, where it comes from, how we process it, and whether it is really what it says it is. To get food from country to kitchen, we're now seeing labyrinthine production chains that spread all over the world, and with big business comes bureaucracy.
Our first guest today is looking at how some of the figures from the food industry just don't seem to add up. Paul McMahon is an investor in sustainable agriculture, and his new book, Feeding Frenzy, takes a deeper look at why food production should be the top of the table when it comes to market scrutiny. He joins us now to explain a little bit more. Paul, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Now, your book starts with a very interesting image which really sums up a lot of the themes that you're looking at here. This field in the middle of East Africa with these enormous trucks, Saudi trucks, fenced off from locals who are wondering really what is going on. And it turns out the sheikh has bought this corner of Ethiopia and is using it to sort of farm and bring food back, which is one of these things that really sort of sums up some of the madness that's happening in the global food chain. How did you go about gathering anecdotes like this for the book? And do you think that really is a good window into what is going on?
Hmm. Yeah, I think the acquisition of farmland in countries like Africa and some of the poorest, most developing countries is probably the most striking phenomenon to come out of the world food crisis they've been going through over the last few years. Things started off happening in quite secret ways and quite non-transparent ways, but over the last few years, a lot of researchers have been out in the field interviewing people, monitoring what's going on. There've been quite a few good reports in it, and I've done my own research as well. So, and we have a better idea now of what is actually taking place on the ground.
And Paul, one of the key, I guess, statistics in this book is the idea, and this is slightly what your book is built around, is the idea that there's going to be 9 billion people by 2050, and you're asking a very pertinent question. Can we feed all those people when that date comes? And you have some positive things to say about what we could potentially do. But in the direction we're currently heading at the moment, what's your vision of where we could end up if we don't do things to correct our path?
Sure. I think we can feed 9 billion people. The question is, will we? Because in terms of the amount of land and water and the natural conditions we have, it's not actually a problem. It's one of the distribution of food, access of food, the pricing of food, and actually fundamentally the politics of food. And I think that's where we're seeing some worrying trends around land grabs, around manipulation of trade, around speculation. And I think if those trends continue and are unchecked, then we could see a quite a worrying situation where the richer and powerful countries are able to secure their food supplies, but the poor and weaker countries get a little bit left out in the cold. And if there is a crisis, a supply shortage, then they could find it quite hard to meet their needs.
It's interesting if you look back to some of the food policies that were sort of put in place, you know, in the 20s even, looking towards sort of industrialization of food and really sort of shipping food around the world. Do you think that when they came up with this idea of sort of modernization, that there was really a sense of where it was going and sustainability at all? Is that a kind of recent concept?
I think the global food system has evolved in fairly accidental ways. I don't think it has been particularly planned. I think the emphasis on sustainability is one which has come out probably more in the last 5 years than ever before, partly because we're seeing the supply of food being affected by things like extreme weather events, so droughts and floods, because people are seeing the effects of pollution a lot more evidently now, because the prices are high. So I think there's much more of a focus on it at the moment. In terms of the world trade and trade in food, I mean, there'll always be a need for trade because there'll always be regions that can produce lots of food in other regions which have a shortage. So that's not necessarily a problem. I think, though, there are imbalances which have developed in the system which maybe could be fixed. And there's countries now, lots of poor developing countries in Africa, for example, which should be producing more, could be producing more and satisfying their own needs.
And Paul, one of the interesting stories, you know, I guess we've often heard about, you know, African countries being persuaded into switching land over to, you know, growing flowers or growing food for export. But what seems to be another kind of battle around politics and food is this idea that countries which have been traditionally exporters of food, maybe exporting rice, for example, that actually when they have a kind of a concern about food prices or when they're worried about feeding their people at home, they suddenly put up the barriers these days. And actually, other countries which are very dependent on them for their kind of nourishment are cut off almost overnight. Is this just a reality of the way that the global market is working? Is there anything we can do about it? What's your concerns around this issue?
It's certainly a feature of the current global food system. The UN did a study of 105 different developing countries, and they found that, I think, about 33 put up those kinds of export bans or restrictions at the time of high prices and crisis. So it seems to be a bit of a knee-jerk reaction from a lot of countries at the moment. What we can do about it, it's quite hard. I mean, the G20 and other global governance bodies have tried to introduce some checks and balances, some rules. But I think fundamentally, countries act in their own interests. And so I think if we do see further spikes in prices, shortages, we will see countries acting this way. So I think it's up to the other countries who maybe rely on these markets to do as much as they can to develop their own productivity and self-sufficiency.
And where do you stand on genetic issue? Do you think that that is the future and that we can't feed the world without modifying, you know, the crops that we have? I mean, it's so divisive internationally. Do you think that we can do without science like that?
I think there's definitely potential in genetic modification, but the reality so far is that the technologies which have been produced in new seeds, for example, they may have made some farming operations slightly simpler, but they actually haven't improved yields to any great extent. So actually it's not allowing us to grow any more food. In the future, we may see new genetic modification technologies develop, which could change that. But at the moment, it isn't really delivering. So I'm open-minded about it. Scientists should continue to do the research. Let's see what we can find. But at the same time, we can't wait for that. There's plenty of other proven tools and techniques at the moment which are there, which we could use, we could scale up, and will grow us a lot more food.
And Paul, tell us a little bit about your journey into this field. So you've been an advisor to Prince Charles and to the UN, and you've looked at kind of sustainability and farming around the world. What was your background that brought you into this world?
I came at this from two sides. One is the investment side. So I've always worked in finance and sustainable investment. Other side, looking at policy and research around economic development and environmental issues. And so those two came together about 5 years ago, where I began to see that big demands for food were coming our way, prices were increasing. There was both opportunities in terms of investment in the right models, at the same time some of these risks and threats, the way the world was going. So yeah, I became very interested in this probably 2008 and sort of tracked the development of the food system since then.
And can I just ask you on that, you say investment, so I guess you know that the nature of people who ask someone to invest on them for them, they're hoping to make some money, they're hoping to see some return. But you're talking about issues here where you seem very concerned that actually many of the people involved in this food chain have no opportunity to really kind of give any more. What's your balance as you come into this world as an investor?
Yeah, I think there is a positive role for financial capital to play. I think it isn't investing in commodity speculation, commodity futures. I think it is investing in real productive assets. So whether that's helping farmers change their practices, whether it's investing in roads or in infrastructure, all along the supply chain into the processing of food, the handling of food, the storage of food. So there's a great need for investment into the right kinds of systems. And my own belief as well is that there's a particular role for investment to play in backing a shift towards more ecological farming systems, which use less finite resources, which are less polluting, and which are truly sustainable. And I think there we can have the right balance where investors can make a return and we can also see the right outcomes for society at large.
And what do you think the future really holds? I mean, there's been so much talk and almost a kind of Malthusian sort of pessimism around, but do you think that we really can feed the world but also go back to this more sustainable, even family-run businesses? Do we need these super tractors that you're talking about in the books to pull this off?
No, I think if you look around the world today, probably most of the food is still being produced by small farmers, by small family farms. And in China, India, Vietnam, Cambodia, all across Asia, the average size of farm is 1 hectare, 2 hectares. So it's quite small. And they produce still most of the world's food. So it doesn't have to involve massive commercial farms. I think as countries go to phases of economic development, they tend to shift from small farmer dependence to slightly bigger holdings, and there's a gradual transition they go through as other parts of the economy take off. But I don't think you can skip that. I think countries need to go through it at their own pace.
And Paul, finally, without simplifying things too much, can I just ask you a few headline topics that seem to be in the papers all the time, and you can just give us your snapshot opinion. The idea that we should eat less meat, if we didn't eat so much meat, that would save the world.
I think we need to eat the right kind of meat. And so meat which is produced from grains in intensive feedlot confined operations, there's a lot of problems with that in terms of the food it takes away from other people's plates, but also the pollution and the diseases it can cause as well. I think, for example, meat, whereas grass-fed, pasture-raised cattle or sheep or even pigs, that can be very sustainable as part of a broader mix integrated farming systems.
Biofuels, good or bad?
Biofuels can be very good. I think they're here to stay. They're going to grow. I think we need checks and balances so if they get into competition, that food can be released from biofuels and put back into the food economy.
Throwing away food, how bad is that?
Big issue, 30% of food is wasted. In poor countries, it's more the end of the farmer. In rich countries, more the end of the consumer. So the food ends up in the fridge rotting and people throw it out. The problem is how do you solve it? In a way, I think it's more of a symptom, the fact that food, we don't care for it enough. Maybe it's too cheap. You know, we take it for granted. So we need to start really paying for food and for paying what it's worth.
And finally, should I feel guilty about eating a banana that's been shipped halfway around the world?
Not necessarily. If you want to eat bananas, you have to ship it halfway across the world. I think there's right ways to grow bananas. Trade is not a problem. So no, you don't need to feel bad eating
bananas. So we don't need to worry about the food miles as everyone seems to be scaring us about these days.
You need to tot up all the different factors go in. So even though it's been transported, that could actually be the smallest part of the carbon output of the banana. It could actually be the way it's been produced, which is more important. So you got to look at the thing in the whole. So.
Paul, thank you.
Did anyone warn you this wasn't going to be an interview but an interrogation?
You've passed the test.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Yeah,
thanks very much.
We love to champion retailers who make a point of differentiating themselves from other offerings on the high street. Our latest Monocle briefing film travels to Buenos Aires, New York and Budapest to visit specialist shops where making is at the heart of their retail offering.
One of the big challenges with any denim brand or any brand for that matter is to really try and explain to the customer why it's special, why it's unique, and why it's worth investing, you know, a lot of money in a great product.
You can view handmade retailers and over 300 more films and slideshows on monocle.com.
We'll be finding out how to create a good idea next, and more importantly, how to spread one. But first, we'll have some music. Here's some bouncy, brand new Icelandic pop to ease you into Monday. This is Retro Stefson with Glow. That was Glow by Retro Stefson. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Sophie Grove. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Here at Monocle, we like to think we've had a good idea or two, although that doesn't mean they've all made it onto the page or onto the airwaves. A little bit of feedback here and there often makes a good idea better. And bad ones, well, we don't really talk about those.
Our next guest is Jonah Berger, a professor of marketing at the University of Pennsylvania, and his new book, Contagious, explores which elements help good ideas spread and go that little bit further. Jonah, thank you very much for joining us. I'll ask the cheeky question first. So if this book isn't a success, it will probably turn out that you don't know the lessons that you're telling everyone about, because this is a book about contagion and about how you get an idea to be adopted, to get it to spread. Could you just explain to us the roots of your idea?
Sure. So I think often people think why products succeed and catch on is due to advertising. Maybe, you know, a company spent a lot of money. Or maybe it's due to luck or chance. Some things succeed and others just fail. Or maybe it's even quality. Some are better quality and better quality things went out. But what the book is all about, and is what many of your listeners probably realize, a lot of the reason that things become popular is more about social influence. A person liking or enjoying the product and sharing it with a friend or a colleague, and encouraging encouraging others to adopt it as well. Social influence and word of mouth drive most everything to catch on. And so what this book about is explaining why social influence work, what drives word of mouth, and how companies and individuals can apply these concepts to help their own products and ideas become successful.
Now, before I let Sophie jump in, can I just pick up two words that you used in that introduction there? Share and social. Now, lots of people seem to think that spreading a good idea these days is all about just harnessing the internet, and that if you do the right thing on the internet, then you've got a success on your hands. But in fact, you point out it's much more complicated than that. In fact, one of the important tools is word of mouth, and that actually the internet isn't so good as that as you might think.
I think we all tend to think, oh, social media is the big driver of word of mouth. And there are definitely a lot of big sites like Facebook and Twitter and now Pinterest and others. But it's actually surprising how little word of mouth is actually online. Many people think it's 50%. It's closer to 7% of all word of mouth is online. A huge chunk of word of mouth is offline, face-to-face conversations, whether talking to your colleagues around lunch, talking to your family at dinner, or talking with some friends over a beer at the neighborhood pub. These are cases where we're not on our phones, we're not on the internet, we're speaking to one another face-to-face, and that's how most ideas spread between people.
I mean, you've spent quite a lot of time looking at, you know, the phenomenon of the fad, really. I wondered, have you sort of concluded that we're really intellectual sheep? Do we follow each other completely? I mean, and how do you unpack that sense of things all sort of, you know, this viral rush towards one idea?
I think when you use the word sheep, it sounds like a bad thing, right? No one wants to be a sheep. No one wants to be a lemming. We think those are negative ideas. But in many cases, following others is really useful. Imagine, you know, you're in a strange city, you've never been there before, and you're trying to find a place to eat dinner. What do? You look around and you see, well, where's full? If this restaurant is full of people, it must be pretty good. And so we often rely on others as information about what's the right thing to do and what's the wrong thing to do. And so I think, yes, you're right. We often do follow others, but it's not as negative as we might think it is.
Now, Jonah, obviously you're doing this book to help people who run companies or have ideas that they want to get spread and to take off. But the interesting thing is, I guess, that many of the things you're looking at, the risk is that contagion can be short-lived, that you can create some noise, you get something picked up, that everybody is, you know, spreading the YouTube video, but actually after a week it's gone. How do you build depth next to contagion?
You know, I think it all comes back to the original idea or product itself. Sure, a meme on the web, a cute little video or something like that, the value of it's sort of in its novelty. We value it because it's new and it's different and we haven't seen it before, and next week we'll move on to another new thing. But to the degree that your product or idea has some substance, it's a useful product, it's a helpful service, it's an idea that's going to help the environment or change politics forever, the functional value of that will help that idea persist. You're very right. Things that catch on quickly, our research shows they tend to die out quickly as well. But things that have more of a functional benefit do tend to stick around. It's not about doing something crazy and just getting attention. It's about creating lasting value.
And Jonah, you talk about ideas as being a Trojan horse and almost sort of being the sort of idea of them clandestine and sort of sneaking into people's psyche. Do you think that ideas do travel like that? And is there something that is really completely intangible about a thought or a fad?
I love the idea of a Trojan horse because I think it beautifully encapsulates the way we share information. We don't want to seem like advertisements. We want to pass along stories, whether they're funny stories, entertaining stories, useful stories, or stories just to fill the space in between conversations that, well, where there's silence. But within those stories, just like a Trojan horse, there's often a hidden message, moral, or information inside. You might be telling someone about how you got upgraded to first class on an airline recently, but along the way, you're spreading the name of that airline inside that candy shell of a story. Or you might pass on how you recently went to a new store and they had a great sale. You're spreading the word about the great sale, but you're also sharing information about that retailer as well. And so many stories and ideas are like Trojan horses. They have an exterior that makes us want to pass them on, but along the way for the ride comes a product or a benefit of that brand.
Now, Jonah, I think you also must take the prize for some of the best subheadings in chapters ever written. I must let the listeners know a few of them. Is the Apple logo better upside down than the right side up? Why dying people turn down kidney transplants, using mustaches to make the private public, and also why hikers talk about vacuum cleaners. Why do hikers talk about vacuum cleaners?
That doesn't make any sense, right? Why would hikers, of all the things they could talk about vacuum cleaners? One of the principles we talk about in the book is this idea of practical value. It's useful information. And I think this is one of the most intuitive concepts in the book, but it's a very important one. People want to help others. I'm sure they share things that make them look good or make them look smart and in the know, but they also want to pass on useful information, you know, tips about how to eat more healthy, tips about fitness, ways to save money. And so hikers talk about vacuum cleaners. They can't help themselves. Whatever topic you happen upon, if it's useful information, you want to pass it on and help someone else and make their lives better. I was walking with my brother in the middle of a hike we were going, and the people in front of us, sure enough, were talking about this vacuum cleaner and how wonderful it was and how it solved all their household problems. And I was sitting there going, we're in the middle of nature. Why would the vacuum cleaner be what you choose to talk about? But if you think about it, that's what we're doing, right? We're sharing common ground with others. We're connecting with our friends, family members, coworkers, and we're doing it in whatever way allows us to express ourselves and help them as well.
And Joan, I wanted to ask you about the idea of the trigger. This is a very emotional sort of alchemy that happens when an idea takes off. And we often see a sort of mad scramble to buy something or to listen to something. Can you track that? And can you create that? Is this a really, this book is sort of an up yours to anyone that's trying to manufacture that trigger and manufacture the idea of the alchemy of something spreading?
I think you're right. You have to be authentic. If you're inauthentic, if you're hitting consumers over the head with an ad, or it seems like a blatant sell attempt, they're going to tune out and turn you off. They're not interested in selling things. They're interested in trying to help their friends and others. That said, what our research shows is it's not random or it's not luck why things go viral. It's not chance that certain products get more word of mouth than others. There's actually a science behind it. It's the psychology of talk and, you know, the science of conversation. There are some rules or principles that we follow when we share things with others, and they're both interesting just to be aware of as an individual in the world, but also helpful for companies and organizations who want to generate that word of mouth. You might have thought, oh, you have to strike it rich or, you know, get lucky to get people to share your product or idea. But what our research shows is if you follow these principles, you're guaranteed to get people to be more likely to talk and share.
Can you give us an example of that? For instance, is there a moment that, you know, a headline has changed something quite pedestrian and into something quite exciting and really worked? I mean, do we respond to, you know, these bright colours and interesting things as human beings? Is this about, you know, fireworks really, visually or intellectually?
So we did some research, for example, on the New York Times, one of the largest newspapers in the United States. They have a big most emailed list, the most shared articles of the last 24 hours. And we looked at 6 months of articles from that newspaper, a full half of year, over 7,000 articles that they released. And along the way, we looked at the content itself. What about the content made people want to share it? And what we found, for example, is articles that evoked awe and the emotion of inspiration were about 30% more likely to be shared than articles that didn't evoke as much of that emotion. Anger-inducing articles were about 25% more likely to be shared. Practically useful articles, useful information, were about 20% more likely to be shared. And so what this research shows again is, yep, you know, there is different articles have different characteristics. I can't guarantee, and no one can guarantee, that you'll have a billion views for your content. But just like a recipe, if you include certain ingredients, it'll taste better. If you include certain ingredients in your newspaper article or include certain ingredients in the way you build your product or idea, people are going to be more likely to share it with others.
Well, Jonah, thank you very much, because I think me and Sophie have been writing down a few tips to make sure that our stories are shared and talked about. We need to extend our careers a little bit beyond this show today. Jonah Berger, who's the author of Contagious, thank you very much for joining us.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly.
If you've ever wondered how the shirt on your back came into being, or the roof over your head, the chair you sit on, the laptop you tap on, the office you work in, the train, plane, car, boat, bicycle and lift that transport you, the phone you talk on, or even the bath that you soak in. If you want to know about the things that you live with, then tune into Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dip into the world of design. Premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, we hop from front row to back street, workshop to fairground, taking in the latest in the worlds of architecture, fashion, retail, transport, technology and graphics. If you want to know how design impacts your daily life and who the people are dedicated to making life better, then pull up a pew and tune in.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
In an age of austerity, the old joke about having a license to print money gets thrown around fancifully. But creating your own new currency isn't just restricted to nations and powerful figures.
Our final guest today is Stan Stornaker, who founded the social network for businesses Hub Culture in 2002. Over the past decade, he's been working to create an electronic currency for those businesses to trade that bypasses many of the present trappings of the banking system. And the result, the Venn currency, now legitimately competes on floating exchange rates with the likes of the dollar. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Edwards sat down with Stornaker to find out the value of doing things your own way.
Stan, thanks very much for coming to speak with us. I guess the best place to start is perhaps if you can fill us in on a bit about Venn, talk to us about the currency, the idea behind the project and the kind of the main drivers behind launching that kind of initiative.
So the Venn is a phenomenon that really grew out of a social network called Hub Culture. And Hub Culture came from a book that I wrote about 10 years ago that looked at the social side of globalization. And so this idea that people were becoming almost post-national and were part of a global community that was largely urban-based. And we started one of the first social networks at that time to start to collect and engage these people. And it grew in a very unique way because we were doing a lot of things face-to-face with events and activities that this community could go to. And over time, we were selling tickets and started selling merchandise and goods through the online stores that were attached to Hub Culture. And we had a lot of people from a lot of different places. And really out of sheer laziness, we realized that we needed a single currency to be able to price things. And so in 2007, 5 years ago now, we created the Venn. And the idea was to create a single currency for our community, which at the time was not a very common idea. And even 5 years ago, the idea of virtual currencies were really not very well established at all. We were really one of the first ones. And we were definitely the first one to move from, say, a gaming system. So things like Second Life or World of Warcraft had internal currencies, but really good for digital goods and services. We were the first people to take a virtual currency and move it into the real world and to start to sell real world goods and services and to enable our community to trade. And so that was one of the key things, is that this currency was designed from the beginning to be exchanged peer-to-peer. And the best way to do that was really through the web. So we launched it July 4th, 2007 on the web. In the beginning, it had no exchange rate, so we weren't even sure what it was valued and how we would value it within the community. Within a few months, we started selling goods and services, and so we added an exchange rate, and that started at 10 points, 10 Venn to the dollar. And then from there, it began to evolve, and it just took on a life of its own. And, you know, it's now a very different product. It became the first virtual currency to be used for trade, the first for peer-to-peer exchange, and then the first to move to a basket. So we realized if it was truly going to be global, it couldn't just be linked to the dollar. And so we developed algorithms that took financial pricing and evaluated the dollar and the yen and the renminbi and the euro and put it into what we call a basket. And that created a single price. So instead of being 10 Venn to the dollar, it became, say, 10 Venn to a basket of currencies. And then from there, we realized that we could actually evolve it farther. And the really, I think, groundbreaking innovations came in 2009 and 2010, where the basket was expanded to include commodities. So it became the first currency in modern history to be backed by gold and oil, silver, agricultural commodities. And then we realized that we could add carbon. And this was, for me, the most important and fundamentally important thing about the Venn. We added carbon futures in 2010, and that kind of made the basket complete. And the carbon futures that are in the currency made it possible for us to create a green, economically and environmentally sustainable currency. And the way that works is that if you, say, issue Venn out to a new user who's purchasing it, you have to hold, or we have to hold, 100% of the value of that in reserve. And as the float, the size of the economy grows, we have to invest that into the basket. So that means we become a net buyer of carbon. And so the larger the Venn grows and the more people that use Venn, the more we have to invest into carbon as a mechanism for the basket.
Now talk to me a little bit about how these kind of industries then are regulated, because I imagine a lot of people say this is something that sprung up, there was almost an organic development to it. A lot of, I'm sure, you know, great minds behind it. You're talking about algorithms, programming, this kind of things. How does the regulation work? How does this fit in within what we would consider the kind of established framework of international currency dealing, commodities dealing? How does it fit in, and where does the regulation come from?
So the regulation is still a little bit gray in the area of virtual and alternative currencies, but there are some clear markers that have been set out on a global basis. It does vary a little bit from market to market, but the European Central Bank just issued their first report on virtual currency in the fall, which was something of a surprise to those of us who work in this area that the ECB was seriously considering this as a thing. And a lot of that was really a response to Bitcoin, which is another virtual currency that is different from Venn, but also similar. It came a couple years after Venn, and it has very different characteristics. But from a regulatory standpoint, there has not really been any legislation around these things in terms of virtual or digital currencies. But there is some ruling and some work that's been done around the idea of alternative currencies in general and around currencies that would, for instance, compete with a nationalized currency. But by and large, it's been regulation-free, especially the area that we're in. And when the ECB report came out, it was very interesting because they really bucketed these currencies into three types. And so the first type is something that's just issued for points. And so something like your Amex rewards or airline points, these sort of point systems would sort of fall into that first bucket. They're not exchangeable, but you can buy stuff with them. And especially within, say, gaming systems. So your Zynga points for Farmville. And that's a multi-billion dollar industry, by the way. And then the second area where there are really no other players other than Venn and Bitcoin is where you have tier two, and these are exchanged peer-to-peer. So Venn can be exchanged to anyone on the planet effectively instantly. And it's probably the most efficient monetary exchange system on Earth right now because there's no erosion of the value. If you tried to send a dollar to someone in Stockholm and then that same dollar from Stockholm to Tokyo and then from Tokyo to San Francisco, you're going to have erosion of that dollar currently under most systems. When you're sending Venn, there's no erosion. That dollar holds its full value for exchange. The key difference is that when you move from tier two to tier three, you have what they call a secondary or external exchange. So when you go from dollar to Venn, fine, and that's well within the boundaries, but there are limitations for how you can go from Venn back to dollar. And so there are money laundering and arbitrage issues around that. And the kind of general ruling is that as the central bank, us, the central authority, there are limitations to us being able to sell dollar to Venn and Venn to dollar, because it, especially for money laundering, it could cause a problem. So we stop at that, and we then curate a very large selection. We have over $100 million of goods and services that you can buy with the Venn, but not cash. But at the same time, you know, we were the first people to launch derivatives with virtual currency, the first people to launch mutual funds that are basically investment funds, all priced in virtual currency. You can buy anything from diamonds to a car with us, but you can't get cash back from us. Now, that said, the Bitcoin economy, which is larger and in fact is now approaching well over $300 million that have been translated from cash into Bitcoin, 60% of that growth in the last 3 months, does have secondary exchange. And there are reasons for that are different from ours. The key reason being that there's no central authority with Bitcoin. So there's nobody for the US government or the European Union to go and track down to hold accountable for that.
It is very liberating, potentially. As you said, there's so much freedom, potentially, and there's more value, I guess, from all ends of the operation. But those concerns you mentioned about, for example, money laundering, the kind of ease of access to these funds, is that a problem? I mean, possibly, as you said, Venn maybe skirts some of those issues. But some of these other players on the scene, is that a genuine issue? I mean, I know there's problems with things like the so-called dark web, access to all kinds of questionable, you know, goods and services that are available. How do you ensure that this thing doesn't take on a life of its own and becomes completely unregulated and is there is too much facility for the, you know, money laundering, for example, to take place.
Well, that's really the key difference between something like Venn and Bitcoin. I mean, Bitcoin, I know a lot of people that work in the Bitcoin economy, and there's a lot of great people doing great things. There's a whole ecosystem of startups now that are moving in to try and take advantage of it. And I know of two hedge funds that are buying Bitcoin, which is fundamentally amazing. But beyond that, the reality is that a decentralized, anonymized system, which is the kind of hallmark of Bitcoin, is different from a central transaction, transparent system like Venn. I kind of compare it to like BitTorrent for like illegal downloading is to Bitcoin, as say iTunes is to Venn. So Venn, you know, because we're a legitimate and respectable company with 100% reserve backing for the currency, we know that there are limitations that require us to play within the legal frameworks that are out there, as well as the trust frameworks from consumers. And so for us, the main trust framework is that 100% reserve policy to make sure that the Venn is fully backed. I mean, no government even backs their currency by more than 1% or 2%, let alone 100%.
Where does this all end? I mean, I know you've written and talked before about how these kind of currencies, other things of value, will end up being sort of judged by some kind of unified system. Is that the kind of end game of all this? Is that where it winds up? Or is it not as simplistic as that?
Well, great question. And I've been sort of probably the first person to propagate the idea of what I call singular value, which is really currency will become obsolete in the near future. And information itself will become money in the near future. And so this is really being driven by the internet. But probably the easiest way to explain this is that if you think about the social graph on the web, so Facebook likes and clout scores and just nodes on the internet moving to billions and billions of different nodes that are effectively becoming measurable, you could imagine that at some point in the near future, you would sort of have proxies for things, so some kind of representative on the web. The best example right now is Amazon. So you have a book on Amazon and it's worth, you know, $29, or you have a grocery item, or you have a rubber tire, or whatever it is. Increasingly, services and people have varying values and scores, whether it's your clout score or anything like that. So if you look at like the midterm future, not necessarily in the next couple years, but mid-range out, you can imagine a world where all these points on the social graph have a value. And once those points have the value, they can be compared. So in this regard, everything becomes a currency. Tulips and diamonds and Warby Parker sunglasses and, you know, all these things have value and can effectively be calculated in real time by the web. So the web itself will become the exchange, the medium of exchange, and the value of things will still have markers, but the markers will have multiplied vastly. There's a lot of work right now around like VenX and BitcoinX, where we're looking at, and other people are looking at how you personalize currency. This is really the next big thing. Soon we'll all have our own personal currency, and that will trade against other people's personal currencies.
Very sobering thought. Plenty to get our minds around, and we better get our minds around it fast. Stan Stornaker, thanks very much for coming to talk to us about it.
Well, Sophie, thank you for being the new Rob.
Oh, well.
For this week, anyway.
Big shoes to fill.
Actually, very big shoes. Quite big shoes. Quite suede-y shoes.
Suede-y, yeah, sort of dashing.
And a little suede-y. Bit louche.
Yeah, well, he'll be very welcome back when he comes back. Well, he's coming back next week.
Yes, he will be back next week on the Monocle Weekly. But I think we've done highbrow. We've done almost lowbrow. We've talked about Tom Edwards a lot.
That was fun.
I think Tom Edwards is kind of alter ego is amazing.
He is. I think we should invite him onto Monocle 24.
Maybe he should be our guest next week, the double studio. Edwards. Maybe we should, an Edwards-themed show. That would be good that they could have the two Edwards on. Ed is all round. It would be good. It would be very good. Well, I very much enjoyed it. Are you here next week? Or are you going away?
I'm in Cannes.
Sadly, you're in Cannes. Oh, yes, you're going to MIPIM, which is the big real estate conference.
It is. It's really one of the most fascinating big jamborees where people sort of lay out the plans for the next great big new city in Gdansk or, you know, a whole new regeneration of, you know, urban areas. And it's really serious. It's kind of architecture on steroids.
Good.
Well, I'm here all week. I'm going to be looking after that lovely book for Gestalten, so that's coming your way. Look out for it in the bookshops, please, in autumn. That's if we ever get it done. But anyway, I think that's all for this week. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening to edition 192 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio manager was the one and only Jack Phillips. We'll be back next week. But until then, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And goodbye from me, Sophie Grove.
Goodbye.